time's about 2:52, and you're on.
Good afternoon, Mr. Zubra. How are you?
Good.
Am I pronouncing it right?
Yes.
As you probably know already, we're with the Financial Crisis Inquiry Commission, a bipartisan commission set up by Congress to investigate the causes of the financial crisis and to do a report due December 15th, 2010, County. We're here to talk to you about the risk management practices at J.P. Morgan. Because we're with the government, I'm obligated to tell you that the normal rules of dealing with the government apply. That means you have to be truthful to us, but I have no reason to believe that you're not going to be truthful. I'm just required to put you on notice for that. Just for the record, if we could go around and say our names so we can get the tape right. And before I do so, do you consent to the recording of this interview?
Yes.
This is Brad Bondi, B-O-N-D-I.
Tom Stanton from the Commission.
Barry Zubro, J.P. Morgan Chase.
Jay Balachek, B-A-O-A-C-E-K, J.P. Morgan.
Eric Goldstein, Paul Weiss.
Jessica Phillips, J.P. Morgan.
Jessica Carey, Paul Weiss.
Michael Palmieri, P-A-L-M-I-E-R-I, Paul Weiss.
Kim Schaefer, the Commission.
Great.
It'd be great if we can start with your telling us about the fortress balance sheet, what it means, and what its function is.
Okay. So I think the fortress balance sheet is, you know, a terminology that, you know, we've adopted, you know, here at J.P. Morgan Chase, and I don't know the exact origination of it, but I would assume it probably started philosophically with Jamie Dimon, the CEO, and it reflected, you know, his belief and the board's belief that it was very important for a financial institution with the breadth such as J.P. Morgan Chase, you know, to have a very strong capital position and a very strong balance sheet, including making sure that the reserves for potential loan losses and other losses that we might incur in the ordinary course of our business, you know, were well reflected through a robust reserving methodology, and that we also make sure that in valuing the assets on the balance sheet that we value them in, you know, an appropriate, you know, conservative way.
Meaning mark to market or fair value rather than historical cost accounting?
It varies depending on the type of assets. We obviously have, you know, lots of different types of assets in the different businesses. You know, some of our businesses are marked on a mark-to-market basis. Some obviously are, you know, accrual accounting or held-to-maturity accounting. But particularly on the mark-to-market type of assets, you know, we want to make sure that we try to properly reflect in a conservative way what we think are the appropriate values from time to time.
And what's the function of fortress balance sheet?
When you say function, I'm not sure.
Why have it, given particularly the record of this company, and I don't know from Mr. Dimon's earlier positions, that shareholders weren't particularly pleased with it. So what is the role of fortress balance sheet?
When you say shareholders were not particularly pleased with it, I'm not sure what.
I wish I could quote the exact New York Times article, but basically implying that shareholders were unhappy with, I don't know if it's returns on equity, but that goes with the opposite of leverage.
Well, I won't, since neither you nor I know which New York Times article you're quoting, I won't comment on that specifically. I guess what I would say is that I think, again, the fortress balance sheet was meant to be a simple description of what we thought reflected a very strong capital position, conservative but appropriate accounting, and in fact, I think that history would suggest that having a fortress balance sheet, particularly through the period of this financial crisis, you know, allowed us to, you know, continue to be in the businesses that we wanted to be in, to continue to earn a return for our shareholders, and in fact avoid, you know, some of the problems that, you know, many other institutions got into.
What I'm trying to get at and understand is whether the importance of a fortress balance sheet is vis-a-vis competitors. In other words, if now there's a big motion to have all sorts of institutions increase their capitalization, is it the relative absence of leverage, or is it the absolute that for each institution that has less leverage, that's a good thing?
I think that it's really important for, I mean, first of all, financial institutions, as you know well, are by their nature leveraged. So I think the question that any financial institution has to ask itself is what is an appropriate amount of leverage to have for the various risks that it's taking. And so on the one hand, that may be a relative concept if you're comparing yourself with other financial institutions that are taking similar types of risks. On the other hand, it's also an absolute concept, absolute as measured against what are the capital standards that the regulators or Congress set for financial institutions, and also, you know, absolute, you know, relative to where other people are, you know, end up being capitalized. But so I think for us, what is and was important is making sure that we continue to evaluate our capital and our balance sheet in the context of the businesses that we were in and the, you know, the risks that we saw, you know, in the marketplace.
Is there any concept in maintaining a fortress balance sheet that it is helpful to have, regardless of the absolute level, more capital than anybody else or than the major competitors?
I would not say that the objective is to necessarily have more than anybody else, because again, you have to compare it to the businesses you're in and what your business strategy is. And you know, I think it's fair to say that there are, you know, very few financial institutions, like probably none that I can think of, that are in all the businesses we're in all the same places we are. So I think that we have to continuously evaluate our capitalization based upon our businesses, and we're more worried about making sure we're properly capitalized than saying that we have more or less than the person next to us.
It was my perception from popular writings that Mr. Dimon had a concept, among others, of maintaining a strong balance sheet because he viewed the financial markets as cyclical, as the case may be, and that a strong balance sheet would allow business moves at a point when the market was weak that otherwise wouldn't be possible. Is that a fair statement?
I certainly think it's fair to say that one of the benefits of having a strong balance sheet is, first, as you said, we are in a cyclical business. So philosophically, we think it's very important in good times to make sure that you properly build up your capital and or, reserve methodologies so as to anticipate the fact that a number of our businesses, not all of them, are cyclical in nature. And so when you get into the downside of that cycle, you are well protected either through loan loss reserving or capital accumulation. In addition, there's no question that by having a strong capital base, business opportunities will present themselves either because other firms change their strategies or get into trouble. And certainly, we saw the benefit of that during this financial crisis, when we were able to act at the government's request in two circumstances, both the acquisition of Bear Stearns and the acquisition of Washington Mutual.
In maintaining the fortress balance sheet, was the potential for acquisitions part of the strategy during good years?
Again, as I said, I think that the key was making sure that we had a strong capital base to allow us to operate the businesses we were in and to recognize that, some opportunities might come along and present themselves, but I would not describe the fortress balance sheet as being, as the objective being for acquisitions. The objective was to be properly capitalized for the businesses and the strategies we were in.
Okay. And to flip around my inartful New York Times example, maintaining a fortress balance sheet, does that have an impact on return on equity?
Well, the math, as you know, is going to be affected by the denominator of the equity. So in that sense, yes, it will always have an impact on the return on equity, but it doesn't necessarily make it, good or bad.
The return on equity will be greater to the extent one has leverage. That's a fair statement.
Assuming that there's earnings, yes.
Yeah, fair enough. There are a couple of interesting questions. One of them has to do with management of liquidity risk.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm curious your thinking now, but also your thinking 2006, 2007. Let me explain a little context, because we're not investigators per se. I'm personally looking at governance and risk management of major financial institutions. We've now looked at 9, and we're trying to understand what differentiates those that are relative successes, and clearly you're one of those, from those that weren't. So that's the reason I'm asking these questions, not because there's some thought in my mind that somehow this is going to be used in some sort of adverse proceeding. It's clear that if you say some crime was committed, that we got to do something about it, but that's a different issue. But I'm curious about liquidity risk, your perceptions now and, say, 2006, on liquidity risk and how one addresses it as a major type of risk clearly that materialized in the current crisis.
Right. So I guess first I would remind you, as you may know, I was not at the bank in 2006, so I can't specifically comment about the bank's liquidity policies or risk management, at that time. What I guess I think is responsive to your question is that, first, I think there is clear recognition that generally financial institutions become either fail or become most distressed through crises of liquidity and crises of confidence, as even before crises of capital. And so, well, really well-managed financial institutions are those that have very clear and robust policies around measuring liquidity and managing liquidity. So I would agree that that's absolutely critical.
Can you describe policies as of the time, November 2008, for managing liquidity and sort of the sense of how one deals with it?
Well, I think that, you know, among the things that are very important to managing liquidity is making sure that you have a base of long-term funding and not be overly reliant upon short-term funding mechanisms, you know, which are subject to, you know, investors deciding not to roll over their financing. And as part of that, it's very important that you have a appropriate matching of assets and liabilities. So, as an example, long-term, illiquid assets, should be funded with, generally, equally long-term types of funding.
What I'm trying to understand, and it's a generic question, so I need some remedial education here.
That is not true.
You'd be surprised. Maybe you wouldn't. Asset liability management is clearly a problem. Long-term funding, so you don't get caught like municipalities did with auction rate securities or whatever. But in a world of repos and in a world of huge overnight exposures and in a world of derivatives of various sorts, how does one manage that piece of liquidity risk?
Well, I think in general, the better way to manage it is to, again, break down the different types of assets and think about how those are being financed. So a financial institution can have a large, repo book in which it's financing, both sides of the repo book, if you will, as part of a, business providing liquidity to customers or facilitating a particular business. So in and of itself, large repo financing is not necessarily a bad thing. Obviously, to the extent that an institution starts to change the complexion of how it uses repo financing to be financing other types of assets, that's where you can end up with a material mismatch in funding liabilities.
And where does the judgment come in as to the benefits of playing the yield curve or otherwise enjoying a mismatch versus being totally cautious and not enjoying any of those benefits?
Well, I agree with your characterization that it is all a degree of business judgment. And I think that you have to remember that the industry of banking is, by definition, in lots of the businesses, represents a maturity transformation business. So there will be funding of, banks receive deposits, which may be overnight deposits, they may be term deposits, and banks use that funding source in part to fund longer dated loans, to consumers, to corporations, municipalities, whatever. And so there's clearly always got to be a business judgment as to what's the stability of that deposit base to help fund the long-term assets. And I think that any individual financial institution, you know, needs to evaluate the character of its deposit base just as one element of the source of funding in order to try to gauge what is the likely liquidity impact, the runoff of those deposits, you know, under different types of scenarios. And so that's certainly one element of liquidity risk management, you know, that any financial institution needs to do.
So you do sort of reverse stress tests with respect to liquidity. Here's what can happen under various scenarios, and here's how it affects our bottom line.
I wouldn't necessarily characterize it as a reverse stress test. I would characterize it as a stress test.
Fair enough.
I think that first and foremost, while the purpose of those liquidity stress tests is not the focus on what can happen to the bottom line, but first and foremost, what can happen to our liquidity.
Mm-hmm.
So the answer is yes, we think about different, you know, runoff scenarios of deposits or other, you know, funding to make sure that we have adequate funding to be able to withstand, you know, periods of market illiquidity or depositor runoff or other inability to access, you know, longer-term funding mechanisms. I think it's obviously worth noting that during one of the interesting challenges that we have in looking at these stress tests, you know, today is that during this financial crisis, in the worst, you know, financial crisis, et cetera, we had a flight of deposit intake.
Yes.
So our deposits went up, they didn't go down. So we don't today run a stress test and say, okay, well, let's look at what happened during the worst financial crisis and see what happens mm-hmm. to our deposit base and pretend that that's the way it will always be.
When by the time you stepped in November of 2008, we'd already undergone some serious liquidity issues in the market. When you got here, what was your opinion of the stress tests that were being applied to liquidity and how good they were?
I think that I thought that they were very robust, and I thought, you know, took into account, you know, a appropriate broad range of different types of scenarios and thought processes. So I was, you know, when I got here, very impressed with what the bank was doing.
So you didn't make a lot of changes to that part of it?
I would not. Yeah, that is correct. I did not make changes to the basic, you know, process of the liquidity stress testing. You know, obviously, as we went through the financial crisis, you know, we continued to update, you know, different models, different scenarios, different ways of thinking about how, you know, the then current crisis or projected other crises might impact the bank. As I said, you know, I thought that we had a very good, you know, most importantly, we had a very good process around thinking about these issues.
And this is as good a place as any to ask the question about model risk. How do you manage the interface between results produced by a model and whatever scenario somebody programs and good judgment?
Well, I guess the first thing I'd say is that models are there as a tool for management to think about it. It obviously depends on what the model is being used for. But I think in the context of your question, models are used as a really as a tool to look at different types of scenarios. But ultimately, it's up to management judgment to figure out how to apply, a business decision around, how much liquidity to have or what type of liquidity to have. It's not like we have a model that says, okay, it ought to be, deposits should be priced at this level or you should have this much of a particular type of funding.
And what about on the input side? Where does judgment go? I mean, it's been a classic problem that the quants sometimes can't talk to the business people and vice versa. How do you factor in sound business judgments to the quality of the scenarios that might be built into a model? And how can you be sure that, because these things are so complex, that the scenarios play out in a reasonable way rather than in some mathematical way?
Well, I guess that the most relevant point here is that when we use models for valuation purposes or for capital purposes, et cetera, there's a group of people who develop the models, often in response to a particular business question or need. But then we have a separate group, wholly independent of the first group, that does what we call model validation, so that there's a clear, check and balance on the development of the model, the sources of the inputs, in addition to the various mathematics that, may get embedded in the model.
Can you describe, before we go on to some of the other risks, which are probably less important in this crisis than issues like model risk and liquidity risk, get to credit risk. Can you possibly describe the structure of the risk management organization and how it interfaces with the business side?
Sure. I guess first, remember at JPMorgan Chase, there are six principal lines of business. So, you're familiar with all these, so I won't repeat them all, but there's the investment bank, the commercial bank, retail, et cetera. Within each of those lines of business, there is a wholly independent and distinct risk organization. And so, as a archetypical example, using the investment bank as a line of business example, there is a chief risk officer for the investment bank. That chief risk officer reports directly to me. He, in this case it happens to be a he, is fully aligned with the investment bank and sits on the investment bank operating committee, and is he and his organization obviously are a big important part of how the risks are managed within the investment bank and what the strategies of the investment bank are. But the risk organization is wholly independent of the trading side of the investment bank or the origination side or the other so-called revenue generating side.
So they don't report.
They do not report to them. Again, they report directly to me, but obviously have a close alignment with the other business partners in the investment bank. And within that risk organization are people who focus on, I would describe them as the key stripes of risk that you would typically have in an investment bank, credit risk, and there's a whole organization that focuses on, you know, setting credit limits, giving credit approvals, et cetera. Again, all of those credit people are wholly independent of the loan originators.
But they're within that silo, within the investment bank.
They're within the risk management silo aligned with the investment bank.
Ah, okay. Good.
Then there's a separate risk management group doing market risk, and then operational risk. And so we tend to think about the key risks as being managing across those three pieces. Obviously, there are other very important risks that the overall firm and the investment bank need to manage, such as, you know, liquidity risk, you know, which is managed, you know, within the treasury operations and the finance operations. There's reputational risk.
I was going to ask about
that. There's other operational type of risks which may not be directly managed within the risk stripe, but within which risk has a very important seat at the table in helping to manage those risks.
There is a Dutch economist who looked at the failures on the public regulatory side and came up with a concept of cognitive regulatory capture, which is to say not blandishments offered to somebody, but rather you get so involved with solving the problems with the people you're trying to regulate that you end up taking on that mindset and you're basically absorbed culturally or cognitively into that world. How do you protect against that with the way these people constantly interact and participate in strategy meetings and so on?
Well, I think that the most important way organizationally is to make sure that the risk organization is totally independent of the other parts of the business, and through their reporting directly to me and my reporting directly to the CEO, it creates a strength of independence that allows them to avoid, you know, whatever the cognitive blending was, or, you know, Stockholm
syndrome. Going native, we call it.
Whatever. and so I think that's, you know, critically important. I think one of the other things that, you know, we've tried to do, and I think do here very successfully, is make sure that people view being a risk manager and being in the risk organization a very important career, a very important career, period. And it's a very important career because they have tremendous respect in the organization. They're viewed as contributing enormously to the organization, not just by how do you protect against problems, but more importantly, how do you work with the businesses to help structure transactions or deals or parameters for lending in ways that help grow the business in an appropriate, you know, risk-adjusted manner. One thing that, you know, over the course of someone's career, we try to do is, you know, have people move from both sides of the coin, if you will. You know, so people will move from being in a revenue generating business to being in the risk management side of the equation, using the things that they've learned in their careers on the revenue generating side and applying it in the risk management side. But then similarly, moving people from risk management into revenue generating seats so that they help bring the risk management disciplines, you know, more directly into, you know, those parts of the business.
Is there a change in compensation when they go from one side, say, laterally across to the other?
Not necessarily. There may be. I think that in general, you know, we try to make sure that people are compensated on a competitive basis, you know, reflecting, you know, the roles they're playing in the firm and reflecting that there is a, you know, there's a broad marketplace for the compensation, you know, of professionals in whatever role they're playing. I would say that, you know, our philosophy for compensating risk management people is, as I said, it's recognizing that it is a very important career in and of itself, that we want to make sure that we have, you know, the very best people that we can in the risk management functions. And in order to do that, you know, we have to make sure we compensate them not only competitively vis-a-vis other risk organizations, but also competitively to be able to attract people to want to be in risk management versus other types of professions. That whole bucket of compensation, you know, reflects the fact that there are different types of pressures, different types of, work requirements, you know, on people, you know, in different parts of the bank.
Is there a difference in time horizon of compensation between the risk side and, say, the trading side? One always gets a sense that traders like to be compensated, thank you very much, on this year's performance, where one can imagine a risk function has a longer time horizon. I don't mean to prejudice your answer, but just to get a sense of the nature, sort of the structure of the compensation.
Well, I would say that we don't distinguish between the compensation of risk, you know, particularly senior risk people from senior other people in the firm, in the sense that, you know, a large component of their compensation, you know, is based on the overall compensation philosophy of, you know, JPMorgan Chase, which is to make sure that there's a, you know, there's a cash component to that compensation, but there's also a long-term component that is, you know, equity-based with, you know, a number of requirements both for what the vesting schedule is of that compensation as well as the application, you know, of clawbacks, you know, in the event of, you know, problems that develop, you know, down the road.
I hate to ask it because I know you came only in November of 2008, but our view is trying to look at the financial world on the verge of the crisis. So I'm wondering whether this was also the philosophy in 2007.
As a general matter, yes, I would say that that was the philosophy, you know, prior to, you know, when I got here. I think that we very much wanted to make sure that we weren't trying to treat, you know, different disciplines within the firm disparately as it related to, you know, long-term, you know, incentive plans.
If we can go back to this parallel structure, this structure next to each other, say there's a difference in view and the risk officer wants to suggest lower limits for the business person than the business person thinks appropriate. How does that conversation play out?
So it depends on, obviously, the actual situation as to Are we allowed to?
It's less than impressive for
$20. Even by New York standards.
So it obviously depends on the actual circumstance, but I think the fundamental answer and the CEOs, you know, again using the investment bank as an example, have stated this, you know, to the analyst community. You know, we've stated this in lots of places that, you know, if it comes down to a conflict between what, you know, risk thinks should happen and what the, you know, originator thinks should happen, just as a two sort of ends of the spectrum, you know, risk gets 51% of the vote and the revenue side gets 49% of the vote. And in fact, in my own experience, it's, you know, always been that way. And so I think that the organization clearly understands that in a actual conflict where they come to a senior management forum and say, okay, you know, we want to put this to a vote, you know, they're going to lose the vote. In practice, I think it's also fair to say, you know, as I said, that part of being a good risk manager is to think about ways to properly balance the risks and returns in any given, you know, potential situation. And so more likely than not, there will be ways that are found to help better structure a transaction in order to allow, you know, the credit organization to provide, you know, a credit approval, you know, or figure out, you know, ways to mitigate, you know, certain of the concerns, you know, whatever it is. But there's no question in my mind that one of the strengths of the risk culture at J.P. Morgan is the fact that everybody understands that risk has 51% of the votes.
In a marvelous new book, you are given a paragraph that says, among other things, that you have superb skills communicating with both the board and with traders, and that this was, you know, a good risk management system was always being improved, and you're a symbol of that. I'm curious whether before you got here there were issues communicating between risk and traders that you had to deal with.
I don't, not that I'm aware of, but nor did I, you know, particularly undertake, you know, any deep dive inquiry of that.
So your perception now, at least, or as of November 08, is that those communications are working pretty well?
I certainly think they're working very well now, and in my experiences here, they've worked, you know, extremely well.
One of the, particularly coming from Washington, one of the issues when somebody feels they're being encroached upon by somebody that wants to set limits, one of the solutions is simply you restrict the amount of information that you make available. How does risk protect itself against asymmetries of knowledge between them and the traders you're trying to relate to?
Well, I think it starts with the quality of the people and making sure that we have people who are able to, you know, face off with, you know, the different colleagues in the other parts of the bank in order to make sure that an asymmetry of knowledge which doesn't develop based on skill. And then secondly, obviously, making sure that we have the right roll-up of information about what's happening, what the positions are, what's happening, what are the dynamics of the positioning, and making sure that the data that's used in the risk systems is essentially the same data as is used in the trading systems.
Meaning everybody has access to the same database, or how does that work?
Correct.
And that, at least again according to popular literature, is something that the bank prides itself on, is a strong information infrastructure. Is that a...
We certainly pride ourselves on that. I think we actually have it. And that's not to suggest that we always had that. And certainly if you were to go back in time into the early part of the last decade and the 1990s in various Heritage organizations, Heritage is sort of our word for the banks that came before the current conglomeration. There was probably less robust systems for aggregating exposures, and so there certainly was a significant development effort that went into that, you know, during the mid-2000 decade, which we were very much the beneficiary of during this financial crisis. I think that served us very well, and, you know, similarly on the market risk side.
Again, doing a little bit of reading, not nearly enough. Yeah, unless I'm mistaken, there were several predecessors for your position in the previous several years. Is that a fair statement? There were two before you, or is that, am I conflating a risk position from someplace else?
Well, not knowing who you're referring to, I don't...
Well, there was one. One name was John Hogan.
Okay, so you're that is not correct. So John Hogan is the chief risk officer for the investment bank.
That's okay.
He is still the chief risk officer of the investment bank, and he reports to me. But so one of the things I think you've got to be a little careful in reading, you know, historical information is that with six lines of business and therefore six chief risk officers and a chief risk officer in me at the parent company, or what I call the parent company, corporate, it sometimes, you know, it appears that people are coming and going when in fact they're not.
So it's a relatively stable position?
It's a relatively stable position. I believe that the position was open for a period of time before I joined the bank. But I also believe that prior to that period, there had been a fair amount of stability in the position. And then when the person who was my predecessor left, you know, Jamie and the board, you know, I underwent a search and, you know, for whatever reasons, you know, decided to ask me to join the bank.
Do you have a sense how long that gap was, roughly?
I believe it was around 9 months, but I'm never really bothered to look.
I guess what occurs to me is it's either a sign of phenomenal strength or weakness that during 2008 until November, there's no chief risk officer.
Well, I think it's a strong sign of strength in the risk culture of the organization. And, you know, one of the things that I think distinguishes JPMorgan Chase, the organization, is that the risk culture, first of all, starts, I consistently say that I think the most important thing about a strong risk culture is it's got to start with tone at the top. And we can talk about tone at the top both from the CEO as well as from the board of directors, but in this instance, there clearly, you know, is, was, and has always been a very strong, you know, risk management tone, knowledge, and detailed inquiry, you know, from the CEO, but not only the CEO of corporate, but also embedded in the CEOs of each of the lines of business. And so I think that that risk culture, you know, allows an organization to, you know, go for, you know, some period of time when there isn't, you know, a, you know, individual that may be called the chief risk officer of corporate, but throughout that whole period of time, there were still chief risk officers at each of the lines of business, the same risk infrastructure of risk committees, separation of church and state, et cetera.
And to what extent did this culture travel with Mr. Diamond? For example, the earliest reference I found a Fortress balance sheet just on the web, not doing a detailed survey, was 2002 when he was at Bank One. To what extent did this culture travel with him, and to what extent was it embedded in some of the legacy organizations?
Well, I think it's a little bit of both. Certainly, I think that Mr. Diamond brought a culture, as you said, of the fortress balance sheet, of, you know, acute identification and ownership of risks, a even more focused effort on measuring them, and a recognition that what you can't measure, you can't manage. Having said that, I think it's also important to recognize that there were very strong risk cultures in a number of the heritage banking institutions. And so, you know, I think that the original Chase Bank, you know, had a very strong credit culture. I think the original, you know, Mamie Hammy banking institution also had a very, very strong credit culture, as reflected in, you know, strong credit training programs, you know, hiring young people that really came up through their credit organizations, may have stayed in risk or may have moved into an origination role, but really embedded in the organization, you know, very strong credit instincts, which we continue to benefit today from a number of those people being in very senior positions.
Am I misconstruing something if I hear that the strong credit cultures were on commercial banking type organizations and potentially less so on investment banking type organizations that been melded in?
Well, I think the only investment banking organization that was melded in, putting Bear Stearns to the side, would have been, you know, principally J.P. Morgan. But J.P. Morgan was both a banking institution as well as a you know, emerging investment banking organization, and I did not. You should not take away from my comments as suggesting that there wasn't good, you know, risk cultures at J.P. Morgan, because there clearly were. I was just using as examples, you know, some of the heritage.
And you know, interview Blythe, and the whole interview was basically
right.
About
risk management.
Yeah,
sure.
About risk management and all that.
So
I also have a little bit of an impediment not being a 30-year J.P. Morgan Chase person, that sometimes, you know, I don't even recognize what heritage organization mm-hmm. individuals came from, but recognize that they have great, you know, risk culture.
We've talked about the structure going down, mm-hmm. Now the structure going from the chief risk officer up to the board. What does that look like, and what kind of communications and so on?
Right. So, first, it, as I said, you know, I report directly to the CEO. I am a member of the 17-person operating committee of, you know, the entire organization, which has the CEOs of the lines of business on it and the heads of the critical, you know, functional organizations.
That means administrative and IT and
so it would be certain administrative functions like, you know, HR or the IT operations side, legal, finance, so on and so forth.
Got it.
In addition, I view myself as being, you know, equally accountable to the risk policy committee of the board, and our board has for many years, I know you're going to ask me how many and I don't know, had a separate risk policy committee of the board, and I say separate to mean that it's not the audit committee of the board. And certainly some financial institutions have adopted the audit committee doing both audit and risk management. We didn't think that that was the right approach, and I think that it's certainly served us extremely well having, you know, a separate group of directors who are focused just on the risk management side of the house, in addition, obviously, to their other responsibilities. And there is complete fluid communication between the entire board, but obviously focused in the risk committee, and myself and our risk organization. And so the risk committee of the board meets at every board meeting, and occasionally we'll have meetings in between board meetings to focus on particular topics. Any of the members of the risk committee, and certainly the chairman, you know, feel totally comfortable and will frequently call me or other members of the risk organization if they have particular questions. One of the things that I found extremely impressive here, and to some extent I'm going to say somewhat unique, and my measurement of unique here is having been obviously at other financial institutions and also an advisor to, you know, many, many companies. There is no shielding of the board from information. The risk officers, you know, meet, you know, with the director's risk committee, you know, at the meetings. We go through what the risks are. And as I said, Jim Crown, who is the chairman of the risk committee, will feel equally comfortable calling me with a question or calling John Hogan or someone in John Hogan's organization. One of the things that I think is critical to the risk culture at JPMorgan Chase is that fluidity of communication and the lack of hierarchical shielding of information. So when I first came, Jim Crown called me, you know, with some question about something, it doesn't matter what it was at this point. And so I answered it to the best I could and found out more information and called him back. And I went over to see Jamie and say, well, I just want to let you know, Jim Crown called me, had this question, here's what I told him, blah, blah, blah. You know, and Jamie sort of looked at me and said, well, like, why are you telling me this? I mean, like, you know, like, well, why do I need to know this? And I cite that as an example because it's emblematic of the culture here, which is that the board, you know, can and should have whatever information it wants. And people in the organization should feel comfortable sharing with them information and not feeling like it has to somehow filter up through, you know, the the CEO hierarchy.
Can you think of any examples where the board has added value to a decision?
Yes.
For example?
I think that the risk committee, since that we've been talking about, has been, very helpful in having the discussion of our overall, risk appetite in any particular line of business, be a thoughtful discussion that moves away from the short-term, risks and rewards to a longer-term strategic question of, what businesses do we want to be in? How do we want to be in that business? What should the risk profile be? What should the risk appetite be? So that I think the board, both on the board risk committee, but also the board in general, brings to the discussions that very important perspective of not being the day-to-day business managers or risk managers, and more the strategic managers thinking about the long-term health of the organization.
And I guess, again, you don't know how much of this is Mr. Diamond and how much of this would have been here without him.
That's correct.
I'm always trying to sort that out in my head, the proclivities of the... Now, to what extent... I mean, there are a couple of cross-cutting risks that are significant. Now, again, one of them predates you, but is important, and that is that we keep getting the sense that lenders were being forced to reduce the covenants for their deals because you almost had a Hobson's choice between doing the deal or, don't worry, you lighten up the covenant, get rid of certain clauses, or somebody else will do that deal. Any sense of that from the way people talk to you? Because that had to be a phenomenon more of 05, 06, I suspect, maybe early 07, than late 08.
But I think that's probably, again, depending on which set of businesses, but there were elements of that across different businesses. It was probably more of an 07, early 08 type of phenomenon. And I think that my sense of it, looking backwards, was that there was a recognition that there was a trade-off between certain financial covenants and protections versus, a desire to maintain, market share. And those discussions, were, actively engaged and discussed at, appropriate levels of the firm. People tried to balance, those obvious, risks. A number of instances, particularly towards the end of that period, the firm, thinking about, in this instance, the leveraged loan business, made the decision to not to engage in the business because they thought that the terms were just not appropriate.
And go ahead, sorry. How do you integrate sort of what a covenant says with somebody's assessment of what that means in terms of the credit risk of that particular deal?
It's obviously got to be... The credit judgments obviously need to dramatically take into account both the financial covenant protections as well as the actual health of the obligor. And there certainly is the ability and the desire to try to use certain financial covenants, particularly in the leveraged lending sphere, to be able to try to structure transactions that allowed market access through the benefit of appropriate covenants, you know, for companies that were obviously highly leveraged or, you know, had other issues.
So you would trade off your consideration of the extent of covenants against your perception of the creditworthiness of the counterparty?
I think that we would clearly try to look at the total package of financial covenants, the creditworthiness of the counterparty, and really the financial cushion of the counterparty would be, I think, a better term, as well as the yield on the asset. You know, so what is the return that you're getting for the different types of risks that you're taking, and what was the ability to have, you know, other parties participate with you in the underwriting of or the distribution of that paper.
This raises a generic question of how to manage risk in a bubble. I mean, in a bubble, at least for the earlier years, there are no mistakes. I can rely on a rating agency. I don't need to worry about it. Everything's fine. How does one maintain discipline and manage risk in a bubble and deal with the trading side of the house that views deals that are either constrained or walked away from as taking bread out of their mouths?
Well, first of all, we never rely on the rating agencies.
That was only an example.
Secondly, I think that the way you manage that is through the independence of the risk organization, as we've talked about, and having a risk culture that doesn't set up a trade-off of risk versus taking bread out of the mouths of the originators. That this is, you know, the objective is to build a long-term strong business, which requires being able to think about how you manage the risks, you know, through the cycle. And obviously, the concept of through the cycle is a reflection that there will be, you know, peaks to cycles and troughs to cycles. And I think a recognition that it's always easy to look back and say that you're in a bubble than it is to be in a bubble and look out and say you're in a bubble. But I think through that whole mosaic of independence, pricing, dynamic discussion of structure, that's the best way to try to, you know, avoid the worst parts of a bubble.
And in, again, November of 08, which is a little late for our purposes, when you looked at pricing models, how good were they? In other words, we've talked to a number of institutions where, in fact, benefit of 2020 hindsight, prices were way too low for what they should have done the deals at. Any sense of that in this, in the context of J.P. Morgan Chase?
Well, I think that clearly in a number of businesses, we were not being adequately paid for the risk that we ended up having to take on. I wouldn't per se, you know, call that a pricing model. I mean, generically, yes, but I would describe it more as, you know, reflective of the trade-off that you talked about, which was, you know, how do you balance, the various terms and conditions with, you know, the frothiness of, you know, any particular market.
The other risk that's cross-cutting is reputational risk.
Mm-hmm.
What does the culture here say about reputational risk, and how is that implemented?
I think there's a clear view here of, you know, everybody from the top throughout the whole organization that, you know, reputational risk is the most damaging risk that we have to manage, that I think we constantly try to get people to understand that it takes us years to build our reputation and it can be lost, you know, overnight. That the sometimes the best transactions are the transactions that we don't do, all of which are meant to reinforce the importance of reputational risk. From a process standpoint, whether or not we should do a transaction really has to start with the originators of a transaction making a judgment as to whether or not the individual counterparty is a counterparty that we want to do business with. And secondly, they need to own the recommendation that, you know, we're prepared to sponsor Tom Stanton as a client of J.P. Morgan Chase. If that relationship is going to entail some difficult judgments about the nature of the business or the type of business that you're in, then, again, using the investment bank as an example, but by no means is this limited to the investment bank, the question will come to a independent reputational risk committee of the investment bank, which is comprised of both, you know, senior people on the revenue generating side of the house, ranging from, you know, investment bankers to, you know, trader types, to also having, you know, credit, risk, legal and compliance senior people involved, and they will come and, as a committee, review the transaction and different aspects of it, and figure out whether it's a client that we should take on, or whether it's a structure that we should support, or are there things that we will impose upon the client in order to want to do the business.
Now, is that all transactions, or does it rely on the trader or risk manager, as the case may be, in that business unit to send that?
It is not all transactions. It requires a degree of self-identification, but there's a number of different people looking at something that will self-identify, will make sure that it, you know, gets, you know, into, you know, that committee. And there is also, you know, we don't practice the notion of stare decisis. And in fact, just 30 minutes ago, someone, you know, raised a potential solicitation of a transaction, you know, to me, because they knew I'd been involved in a prior decision. And said, well, you know, here's the situation. This was reviewed by Reputational Risk Committee a year ago. Here are the reasons why we think, you know, it doesn't need to go back to the Reputational Risk Committee. You know, and I said, I didn't say it this way, but I said, nice try. You know, I think that, in fact, things may have changed sufficiently that we should take it back to the Reputational Risk Committee.
And to generalize, can you talk a bit about the flow of risk information up the line? If I read the records, and again, it was before you got here to a large extent, the firm did really well in shedding a number of risks, but on the other hand, had home equity lines, had, I guess, warehouse or pipelines or whatever, where...
Kept the number of risks.
Yeah, kept the number of risks. So what is the nature of the flow of information, and what lessons have you learned about how to enhance that so that the right decision group gets a chance? It's just like a reputational risk discussion, gets a chance to focus and make a considered decision.
Well, I think you're correct that there is an enormous flow of information. And in that flow of information, it's very important, you know, going back to, you know, sort of the old, you know, IBM marketing slogan of, you know, not just data but reality, to mean that you can overwhelm any organization with too much data and not enough information. And so we are constantly, you know, trying to think about how we make sure that the reports we're generating and looking at as a senior management team, but also as a, you know, throughout the organization, you know, reflect what's a better reflection of what's really happening in the business than just dumping lots of data. And certainly one of the things that I've encouraged is constantly looking through reports and making sure that just because we've been producing a report, we don't just keep producing it, but rather think about what's the use of it and who's reading it and how is it being utilized. I also think that it's important that as markets change, we constantly reevaluate, you know, what the limits we have for different businesses, what is the overall sort of risk structure in which we, you know, allow the businesses to operate, so that you don't end up with pockets of risks that you haven't rethought about whether or not, you know, that's an appropriate level.
Is adjusting limits enough to get at those pockets? That's a nice way to express it. How does one get those pockets to reveal themselves?
Well, again, it depends on what is the business. But I think when you think about the trading businesses and think about the limit structure, then I think clearly constantly reviewing the limits is a very important.
And that would include aging or something like that?
It certainly includes aging, it includes size, it includes, you know, credit limits, market risk limits, et cetera. But one of the other practices that has been in place here for a while, again, I can't give you the start date of it, but we constantly refine it, is on a quarterly basis, again, using the investment bank as the example for this, we go through a process which we call RIFLES, it stands for risk identification for large exposures. And it's a process by which each of the different businesses has to go through and try to identify what are those risks that are not being adequately captured in all the quantitative risk measures. And we sit down and each business reviews those at one of the investment bank's risk committee meets weekly, and so at least once a quarter we go through for each of the businesses and review their list of RIFLES. And so as an example of a RIFLE, and you know there's lots of them, but this is just an easy one to understand. We are a large custodian of gold in our vaults. So in London, I like to say, and I think this is true, but don't hold me to it, that we have more gold in our vault in London than is in Fort Knox. Now, so the, what was the rifle about that? It's not like, is somebody going to back up a truck and steal it, Goldfinger, you know, notwithstanding. But instead, what happens if that gold becomes contaminated? Whose risk is that? Obviously, contamination through a nuclear event. And so we went through all the documentation, the customer documentation, our insurance documentation, the customer's insurance documentation, et cetera, in order to assuage our concern that in a contamination event, we would somehow be held liable as the custodian for the fact that it became contaminated.
And I take it you do the same thing with a cyber event and try to model that.
Correct.
I only have a couple more questions. This has been really informative, although please tell me if I have pockets of ignorance hiding in your answers. The first is capital allocation. I take it, I mean, that's almost a basic thing. You will systematically, you as a firm will systematically allocate capital. And what's the interplay between the risk function and the business lines to figure out who gets how much capital?
Right. So, the answer is yes, we do all that. And so I would separate it into a couple of buckets. So there is an annual process of determining how much of the firm's equity capital should be allocated to each of the lines of business. And that's a process that is, you know, ultimately discussed between the businesses and corporate at their business reviews with Jamie Dimon, you know, Doug Bronstein, now the CFO, myself as the chief risk officer, et cetera. And so there's a very disciplined discussion about, you know, okay, the investment bank has allocated $40 billion of capital, and that's what we will use to measure their overall return on equity for, you know, investor disclosure and so on. In addition, there's what I would describe as a very, there's sort of a medium capital allocation process, which each of the lines of business themselves conduct around their operating committees, in which the chief risk officer is a participant, talking about where do they, as a business strategy, want to allocate capital in order to generate appropriate, you know, overall returns and to make sure that they have an appropriate capital for the risks that they're taking. And then finally, there's what I would describe as a very micro level of capital allocation, which is on a loan by loan and a desk by desk level, in which if we're, so take the simple example of making a new lending commitment, that will go through a balance sheet committee process, which is like a cap, it's both a capital allocation process, it's a business strategy allocation process, it's a client selection process in which, you know, risk and credit are represented.
Really nice. Incidentally, does risk play a role in the way compensation is structured across the organization?
Yes. So, again, I would describe it as sort of a macro level and a micro level. So, at the macro level, obviously, overall compensation philosophy is set at the operating committee level, and I am a big participant in that process. In addition, at the macro level, I meet, you know, at least once a year with the compensation committee of the board, and in one instance, we had the Compensation Committee of the Board and the Risk Committee of the Board meet to talk about compensation structures at the board level for just this purpose, that obviously we wanted to make sure that the risk aspects of the business were being properly reflected in the compensation strategies and structures. At the micro level, risk has always been reflected in compensation decisions through the individual review process.
A 360 review?
A 360 type of review. But I would also say that we're going forward, started a little bit last year and will certainly be more implemented, you know, going forward this year, there will be much more participation by the risk officers in each of the LOBs in structuring, in thinking about the compensation structures across the businesses, and in certain instances reviewing compensation arrangements, particularly in the IB, the investment bank, for particular trading desks or trading businesses. Again, all with the notion to make sure that that the risk organization can clearly verify that through the compensation structures, we're not trying to incentivize excessive risk-taking because of the compensation structure. We don't believe we do that, but we think that this is an extra prophylactic against that. And to also make sure that long-dated risks are being properly identified and compensation is being properly geared to be more long-dated in its let's call it vesting for simplicity for those particular types of businesses.
I only have one other question, and thank you. This has been very helpful. You spent a lot of time at Goldman. They had a strong risk culture. Would you compare and contrast a bit about risk management culture practices at the two organizations? I know they are profoundly different organizations in terms of business model, but just to understand a bit about lessons one can learn by looking at both.
So I'll just deal with this question is, again, at a very general level, he's here on behalf of JPM and not on behalf of Goldman. And so just in terms of Goldman's lawyers and representation, that's the issue. That's the issue. We're not in a position, and they would expect probably if you're going to start to talk about Goldman.
I wasn't going to start. This was
no. I'm saying
in his former Goldman employee.
I understand. Can we ask a favor? Maybe for a two-paragraph email once it's been cleared by all the lawyers?
Sure. Just to identify what it is you want.
Are you comfortable as a knowledgeable, experienced person?
Let me answer the question this way and see if this gets at what you're looking for. I think that great organizations with, you know, really strong risk management practices have them because of a very strong risk culture. And a strong risk culture starts with the tone at the top of the organization and percolates through the organization, not just through a risk organization, but through both a risk organization and a revenue-generating organization. I always stumble between how you describe the yin and the yang of it. I think that there are, a number of organizations that, have those strong risk cultures.
I think J.P. Morgan is certainly, you know, one of those organizations based on, you know, what we have today and what I've seen here. I think, you know, Goldman Sachs, when I was there, also had a very strong risk culture, and I, you know, frankly, you know, was honored to be a part of that and to help, you know, certainly grow it and create it when I was there. And I think that it's very important that, you know, organizations, you know, speaking for J.P. Morgan Chase now, you know, continue to constantly reevaluate, remake, rebuild those risk cultures through the type of dialogue that we've talked about, starting with the board all the way down through the organization.
Maybe I can frame it this way. Were there interesting things you learned after coming here that you hadn't thought about earlier in your career? Does that do it?
Well, I would, I don't think this will answer your question, but there was certainly a lot that I learned when I came here, because this is a very large, complex organization in businesses which I had not historically grown up in.
Okay,
but I don't think that was your question.
Right, let me skip over that and ask one last question in a totally different area.
Another last question.
You caught that one too.
You, well, I get a substitute. The other one didn't work. And again, a lot of it would be relevant before November 08. To what extent is it your perception that any regulator, federal, state, international, added any value to the quality of risk decisions at this organization? Forget about the crisis management and the, you know, layman's going down and that part of it. But I'm thinking in the run-up and as the, to what extent, and let me give you my predicate for that, which is that in one organization, though nameless, I read the regulators' reports, and this is an organization that's cost taxpayers a lot of money, and the regulators' report in 2006 was, gee, the risk management function is really good. And then in 2007, it was, well, it's not quite as good. And in 2008, it was, it's really awful. And it didn't strike me there was a lot of value added. And I'm just curious whether what your perception is of the quality of value added from the supervisory side to your deliberations.
Yeah, I think that as a general matter, I've actually been very impressed with the importance of the regulatory relationship, you know, that's embedded throughout J.P. Morgan Chase. I think that we obviously operate in an extremely regulated industry and environment, and over time, there's been a whole series of regulatory guardrails that get erected, which I can't say that they per se limited the businesses that the bank wanted to conduct, but I think that that regulatory framework and outside scrutiny from supervisors around the world does help contribute when taken seriously and viewed from, you know, the concept that, you know, the regulators are there for a legitimate, you know, role and purpose, to the overall, you know, risk framework that an institution, you know, should be operating in. In addition, I think it's worth noting that, you know, J.P. Morgan Chase as a home lender did not engage in, you know, providing option arm mortgages. Now, again, since I wasn't here, I don't remember, I don't know exactly, but I think that that was fundamentally a decision that we made because we didn't think that was an appropriate business for us to be in or for our customers. But equally, it's worth noting that none of the national banks under the OCC regulatory guidance engaged in option arms. Mm-hmm. And instead, it was all the thrift, the OTS banks that did option arms. And so I do think that, again, it's to me, forget whether J.P. Morgan Chase said we're not going to do option arms or the OCC said you're not going to do option arms or whether it was sort of, you know, they migrated it through it a little bit together. But I do think it's an example of where, you know, a framework of regulatory oversight, in fact, got to the right decision.
Thank you. It's been very helpful.
My pleasure.
I could say I only have one question, but it's divided into about 30 parts. As we said at the outset, we're investigating the causes of the financial crisis, and so I'd be remiss if I didn't ask you, in your position as Chief Risk Officer of JPMorgan Chase, what you view as the causes of the financial crisis.
Well, I think there were a series of financial crises, maybe not 30, but I think that, and so therefore, I think you have to sort of think about those different strands that ultimately rolled up into the cacophony that we had. But so I think clearly there was an excess of leverage, particularly in the mortgage market, which contributed to, you know, ultimately the housing bubble and the downfall of the credit quality of, you know, many of those mortgages. And that buildup in leverage had, you know, many different sources. Part of it obviously started with a overall policy of, you know, trying to promote home lending in the country. Part of it got generated through individuals wanting to borrow more than they could adequately support with their facts and circumstances. Part of it obviously got generated by the different participants in the lending cycle, both the banks in certain instances, but also, you know, the real estate brokers, the mortgage brokers, the real estate appraisers, all of whom helped feed a notion of, you know, more borrowing was appropriate and came up with strategies and products that fundamentally built too much leverage into the system. And so I think that was a big, big part of it. I think that part of the crisis also developed because other parts of the financial market were allowed to become too leveraged, and there certainly was a growth in the both gross as well as net leverage of the former investment banking firms, which would appear to have been facilitated, obviously in part by those individual firms' own business strategies, but facilitated through the application of Basel II capital standards as interpreted under the consolidated supervision, whatever it was called, of the SEC. Right, CSE, you know, as interpreted by the SEC, which, you know, while probably
based in, reasonable principles, ultimately was misapplied and allowed those some of those institutions, not all of them, to become, way over-leveraged with, too much illiquid assets not properly funded or measured.
In the wake of the financial crisis, there's been some suggestion that half of the mortgages outstanding leading into the financial crisis were either subprime or Alt-A. Half of all mortgages outstanding. If that had been, first of all, I guess I'll divide that into two parts. First, were you aware of that when you became chief risk officer in November of 2007, was it? When you became chief risk officer, were you aware of the number of subprime and Alt-A mortgages outstanding in the entire system? And if you weren't, would the fact that half of the mortgages outstanding were subprime or Alt-A have factored into your decision-making for the firm as chief risk officer?
When I became chief risk officer, I was not aware of that, but nor did I have any reason to be aware of it, which I thought you were then going to ask, would it have factored into my decision to become chief risk officer? but I'm not going to answer that. I think if you look at J.P. Morgan Chase, we certainly participated in making mortgage loans that were subprime mortgage loans or Alt-A loans. I think that we ended those practices. My sense is earlier than other institutions, and certainly with much less embedded balances as a relative matter than other institutions had. And I think that it obviously reflected a view that those products had really become, inappropriate, in the context, of the marketplace at the time.
There's some who've said that fair value or mark-to-market accounting contributed to the financial crisis. I wanted to get your thoughts on the issue of fair value and mark-to-market accounting, either with respect to J.P. Morgan Chase or with respect to any counterparties with whom you may have dealt and have knowledge. What role did fair value or mark-to-market accounting play in the financial crisis?
Well, again, I think you have to think about the financial crisis as its sort of subcomponents, if you will, and how fair value or mark-to-market accounting was applied to different financial institutions based on their participation in different markets. So, for instance, an institution like Washington Mutual wasn't really subject to that much of its balance sheet being fair market accounting, and so I don't think fair market value accounting really had any major, did not contribute in any particular noteworthy way to the troubles that Washington Mutual, got into. I think as we talked about, in the firms where the
bulk of their balance sheets might have been subject to, you know, fair market accounting, in particular the investment bank firms. You know, there is a significant benefit of fair market value accounting in that if properly applied, those firms' balance sheets should reflect a current, you know, reflection of what the market value of those assets are. But if that's being done in the mosaic of a regulatory environment that allows those firms to be, you know, more leveraged than maybe they should have been, I don't know whether the trouble some of those firms ultimately got into gets generated because of the leverage they had from the regulatory environment, or whether it comes about because their assets are being, you know, marked down because of fair market value accounting.
In your dealings with counterparties, did you ever encounter any situation where you felt the counterparties were overmarking based on fair value accounting? In other words, taking too conservative of marks or writing down too much their assets. Was there any of that that you witnessed?
Well, I think it's obviously, well, it's certainly hard, you know, from where I sit, to know how an individual financial institution is marking, you know, a particular asset on its books. So I think it's really hard for me to speculate as to whether, you know, XYZ firm, you know, took too big a mark or too, you know, little of a mark.
Rating agencies has been a question that we've been asked to examine as part of our statutory mandate, and the role that credit ratings played in the crisis. Do you believe in hindsight J.P. Morgan Chase relied too heavily on credit ratings for any of its investment decisions?
Well, as I said before, we don't rely on the rating agencies for our credit decisions or investment decisions. We obviously, you know, are aware of what, you know, particular counterparties' ratings might be, but, you know, we make our own independent credit decisions and investment decisions.
Similarly, to the extent that you know, did you ever witness any instance where any counterparty to J.P. Morgan was relying heavily or, to your view, too extensively on credit ratings for any investment decision that it was making, to the extent that you know?
I don't know about particular individual counterparty investment decisions now.
You'd said something at the start which caught my attention, and I wrote it down, and I'm going to paraphrase. You said there could be a crisis of liquidity or a crisis of confidence before a crisis of capital. And I'd be interested to hear your view from your vantage point, how you would classify what happened to Bear Stearns. Was it a crisis of liquidity, a crisis of confidence, or a crisis of capital, and what happened first?
Well, I think that I'm hesitating because the what happened first piece is a little bit hard to separate temporally. I think that one of the things, you know, that did happen first
was an element of, you know, a crisis of confidence in the with the issues that developed around the Bear Stearns hedge funds. I think that created concerns in the marketplace about that category of assets and what the firm's exposures, you know, might be to that. At the same time, as we talked about, Bear Stearns, as one of the investment banks that had obviously engaged in a lot of short-term financing of, you know, a significant portion of its balance sheet that had longer-term assets on it, you know, as, you know, began to experience, you know, a concerns about its liquidity, and as concerns about the liquidity grew, obviously that added to investors' confidence questions. And through both of those processes, obviously, as losses are recognized, there's an erosion of capital. But I do think that in the marketplace, confidence erodes first. Liquidity tends to follow confidence, and typically capital is what ends up being the net result of the impacts of those, and so that's why I said what I said that you quoted.
You also referred to integrating the risk structures of Bear Stearns and WaMu, as you alluded to it. In your integration of the risk structures of Bear Stearns, did you form any opinions, officially or unofficially, as to the failures of risk management at Bear Stearns?
I don't recall saying we integrated the risk structures.
Integrated the structures.
We certainly took the positions that were on Bear's balance sheet and moved them onto, you know, our risk systems, and operational systems, et cetera. In certain instances, you know, there may have been obviously certain, you know, models or whatever that, because of the uniqueness of certain assets, that we would have, you know, brought over. So, you know, our focus was, you know, in the overall business integration of the Bear Stearns businesses, having acquired that into J.P. Morgan Chase, was to make sure that we got the positions, you know, properly reflected on our books and records so that we could properly risk manage them and also properly, you know, account for them, you know, under our, under the way, you know, we obviously manage our books and records. And so our focus was really, you know, if I could say forward looking, to make sure we got the stuff onto our books and records and how are we going to manage it, as opposed to spending a lot of time worrying about how did they get to where they were.
Did you observe, though, any shortcomings in their risk management when you began to integrate the accounts and onto J.P. Morgan's books?
I guess I would say that there were, you know, certainly, you know, we went through with them and looked at where different things, you know, were valued. We went through and made sure that their operational, you know, descriptions of their transactions, et cetera, for collateral management and, you know, other counterparty relationships, you know, were, you know, accurate.
So, you know, we went through all those processes, and, you know, I wouldn't, coming out of that, I wouldn't really characterize one way or the other, you know, that whole, you know, how Bear Stearns had done it.
Did you run any scenario analyses prior to acquiring Bear Stearns as to what would happen to J.P. Morgan if Bear Stearns were to have failed completely?
Had we not acquired it, you mean?
Mm-hmm.
We looked at, we made some rough estimates as to what we thought would be the impact on the marketplace and on our counterparty exposure at the time.
And what were the takeaways or conclusions from those assessments?
The fundamental conclusion was that we thought that, I mean, we thought J.P. Morgan Chase would be, you know, certainly, you know, adequately protected, that, you know, we would be fine in the marketplace. We were not worried about it being a event that would, you know, put at risk in any way, you know, the businesses we were in or, you know, the overall financial stability of the firm.
There's been a lot written about the interconnectedness of the marketplace. I'd be interested to hear your impressions of whether there is, in fact, an interconnected marketplace, one that creates sort of system-wide possible risk versus a perception, rather, that the marketplace is interconnected when, in fact, it may not actually be as interconnected as it's perceived. I'd just like to hear your thoughts as a risk officer. Is the marketplace so interconnected that there could be this system-wide risk if one failed, one firm failed in particular, or is it more so a perception?
Well, clearly the marketplace is interconnected. And so I think that when this perception of interconnectedness gets discussed, I think that it's important to segregate the different types of interconnectedness. So, for instance, there is, you know, there are significant market infrastructure utilities that create interconnectedness of the marketplace, which are systemically critical to the functioning of the marketplace, which, if they were to fail, you know, would have a very a big impact on the marketplace. So, you know, you know those infrastructure utilities as well as I do, but they range from, you know, the New York Stock Exchange to the Depository Trust, you know, Corporation, to certain central clearing operations, to obviously certain, you know, network operations like the SWIFT, you know, payments system. So there's no question that the marketplace is interconnected. Rather, the question is how do we manage that interconnectedness such that we try to have as much robustness in those systems and as much critical capacity in the event that pieces of it, you know, were to fail. I think at elsewhere along that spectrum, you certainly have a degree of interconnectedness of different participants in the marketplace. So Bear Stearns was certainly a dealer participant in the marketplace, which created a series of exposures
were it to fail, one of the stress tests that we constantly run is, you know, a dealer exit or a dealer failure stress test on our books to measure what is our degree of, you know, exposure to such an event. And I think that there has been obviously a significant effort, again, promoted to one of Tom's earlier questions by the regulators to help diminish the amount of that exposure to that interconnectedness, so particularly in the derivatives marketplace, making sure, you know, going back, you know, over the last decade, that there was proper documentation of derivatives contracts, proper back office systems for, you know, all of the types of trading that goes on between firms. So I don't think that you can have the type of robust capital markets that we have today and want to have for all the economic generation that it creates without bringing along with it a degree of interconnectedness. And the issue becomes, how do you manage that interconnectedness and make sure that there's appropriate robustness to what happens if someone does fail?
And how did you view the interconnectedness of AIG, either vis-a-vis J.P. Morgan Chase directly or through any of its counterparties?
Well, in terms of J.P. Morgan Chase, we were not excessively exposed to a failure of AIG as a counterpart. We were not a major derivatives counterparty to AIG, in part because we were not prepared to enter into derivatives transactions with them on the basis on which they wanted to enter into them without appropriate, you know, two-way collateral arrangements. We did have a lending relationship with certain of the AIG subsidiaries, and again, you know, they have a number of different subsidiaries that had different, you know, lending relationships, but none of those were such that it was particularly outsized.
Speaking of collateral, I think I'd be remiss as well if I didn't ask the following. Can you explain to us the chronology with respect to the collateral call that J.P. Morgan made?
Holy blow, they are. You're certainly even, right?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Yeah. The FDIC, Chris, mm-hmm. has sent us a series of questions mm-hmm. about Lehman, and Barry is going to be interviewed in connection with that, but we have not spoken to him about it yet. So I would but we should. It's beyond the scope of today.
If he's already going to be interviewed on that front, I'll let my colleague answer that question. Well, I can't end on an objection because that's sort of a cardinal sin. But I do have one question before Kim, and that is there an area, Mr. Zubrow, that you think has not been focused on in terms of either the literature on the crisis, what's been talked about either in the media or among academics or among policymakers, that you as a chief risk officer say, I don't understand why people aren't focusing more on that?
Well, there certainly is no area of the financial crisis which hasn't been discussed, focused on, written about,
etc.
So, you know, I say no. I do think that we will all, you know, hopefully have the benefit of a productive
economy and marketplace over, the next couple of decades, and be able to look back as historians and figure out whether we adequately responded to the financial crisis. And certainly, your work is going to be a big part of how, both historians look at it and how, we continue to respond to it. But I do think that we're going to have to let the historians figure this one out.
Kim, before you start, just a question. We can ask this a little bit more than 2 hours. If you're short, that's fine.
I'm very short. I don't want to say just one, but it's a very short list. And this may be a bit obscure, but I think one of the things that we've learned among the many lessons is that there was no institutional counterweight to the rating agencies' models and methodologies. I'm speaking in structured finance. So that if they got things wrong, and I'll posit that many people believe that their models were wrong, perhaps it was in part because there not only was there no one reviewing their, no governmental entity supervising and reviewing their models, but there was just no critiquer. There was no pushback. And the only possibility, it seems to me, for that was, in fact, the self-designed models of the investment banks in the consolidated supervision program, where, in fact, all the incentives were the financial incentives, or at least the short-term financial incentives, were towards more leverage and accepting of more risk within the models rather than more conservative models. Do you care to react to that?
No.
Would you care to talk about the models then that you developed for Basel II?
I think that the pushback, as you say, I think the question was not just about the models, but also the natural force that was there to provide pushback was the investor base. And I think that it's critically important in thinking about this crisis that we remember that there are sort of always two sides to a trade, if you will. There's a seller and a buyer. And it would be, I think, inappropriate to absolve the buyers of responsibility for understanding what they were buying, for having their own models, their own ability to evaluate the structures, their own ability to value things. Many of the buyers were big, sophisticated institutional investors that had the financial wherewithal to have those capabilities. Using the structured finance marketplace as an example, and you're a closer student of this, huge amount of information was available. It wasn't a lack of availability of information or disclosure. It was a lack of interest in the buyers doing anything with it.
In the models that... Thank you for that answer. In the models that banks had to develop under consolidated supervision, was there a very sophisticated view of correlation and correlation related to mortgage performance in the United States.
I can't speak to the models because I'm not sure which particular models you might be talking about. I do think that there was a recognition of the importance of correlation throughout, you know, lots of different trading books. It's not just structured finance. That doesn't mean people got it right, but I think that there was a recognition of the issues around correlation.
Since I'm not familiar with you're at the very much at the information advantage. Since I'm not familiar with the models that you had, I'm asking these blinder questions, and I really don't have many. In some of the more market-oriented models or models just you were looking at related to correlation, was there focus on housing price depreciation as opposed to appreciation? Was that a stress run that banks ran?
So we clearly looked at different scenarios around and impacts of housing price appreciation and depreciation. We clearly didn't stress for a depreciation of as large as ultimately occurred, so call it 40%, 35%, you know, depending on what marketplace you're in. And so I think that whenever you do a stress test, you can always stress more. And so there's no question that at the time but the marketplace in general didn't stress it enough. I think in addition, we and probably others didn't appropriately think about what would be the correlation, but although I don't think about that, I tend to think about correlation more as correlation trading than in this instance, but I don't think that we thought about the impact of, as much as we should have, about house price appreciation of the types of magnitudes that we got on the other aspects of consumer credit.
Final question. You mentioned clawbacks before. Was that part of J.P. Morgan's policy before the financial compensation policy before the financial crisis, or was that instituted after?
Certainly, for the senior most management, we've had clawbacks, and I believe for the broad group of senior managers that receive, you know, equity, there's always been a clawback or cancellation provision for a material misstatement leading to a restatement of the financials. We have enhanced the clawback provisions, as I said, you know, last year and, you know, going forward, to have a broader definition of what could constitute, you know, a clawback.
Thank you very much.
Okay. Good.
Thank you very much.
You all.
Very good.
Good meeting you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
5:05 p.m. off record.